It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Ann Strainchamps. Today, workflow. Maybe you feel lucky to have a job. Maybe you love your job. But at the end of the day, well, there's a reason they call it work.
Looks like you've been missing a lot of work lately.
I wouldn't say I've been missing it, Bob.
Work, work, work. I look for a job of both the day and night. I can't find nothing that will suit me right. A little bit of labor I'm not trying to shake, but everything I found seems too much like work.
Sounds like somebody's got a case of the Mondays.
Welcome to the working week. Oh, welcome to the working week.
The American Working Week today, and the American workplace. From the cubicle farm to the co-working facility. Also, the lost history of a hidden American art form, the industrial musical. But first, do you ever get the feeling that your life is becoming less about you and more about the company you work for? Well, it's not just you. Media theorist Doug Rushkoff says corporate culture has taken over a lot of our lives, and it's time to get them back. Rushkoff's the author of Life, Inc., How Corporatism Conquered the World. Steve Paulson wanted to know more.
When you talk about corporatism, what do you mean?
I was looking at the history of corporations and realized that corporations are not this sort of anti-government entity the way we think about them, like there's the market on one side and the government on the other, that corporations are a government-created entity, that corporatism was really a system that was invented really as far back as the late Middle Ages by monarchs who were looking for a way to stay powerful in the face of a rising merchant class. And what they did was really made commerce for people illegal and said, instead, everything's going to have to be run through these state chartered corporations, British East India Trading Company, things like that.
So the implicit deal was that a certain powerful group of people had a monopoly on the commerce in a particular area, and this was sanctioned by the government, and the government got revenue from it.
Exactly. You know, the merchants were in competition with each other. So if you get picked by the king to be the exclusive purveyor of cotton or the exclusive company in charge of the West Indies, that's a good deal, and you're willing to pay 10 or 20% of your revenue to the king or to allow investment by the aristocrats. And meanwhile, the aristocrats, who were basically landlocked, who didn't have any way of creating value themselves, an aristocracy that only had money and nothing else, now had a way to invest that money in order to make money rather than doing something to make money, sort of the old-fashioned labor way.
Well, you're really talking about the rise of capitalism, and yet when we think of that happening, we think about competition.
The funny thing is to see that, well, even though we live in a world now where corporations are free to compete with each other on a certain level, GE competes with Westinghouse or Ford competes with GM. I mean, there's some competition between corporations. There's no competition against corporations themselves.
Now, are you suggesting that this corporate age that we live in is to some degree responsible for our current economic crisis?
The corporate age that we're in is the current economic crisis. You know, there's no difference. The economic crisis that we're in is the crisis of a debt-based economy. I mean, in one sense, when John McCain said, well, this is really psychological, you know, the economy is actually sound, in a weird way, those guys were actually right. Are there people with skills and with needs? Do we still have land on which we can grow crop? Do we still have a manufacturing base? Yeah. We still have all the things of which a real economy can be made. The problem is we live in a virtual economy. We live in a derivative economy. We live in an economy that is fueled by debt.
You're saying in some ways we've stopped being a nation of producers. I mean, yes, we still have producers, manufacturers, and other people who actually make things, but that's not really what drives the economy anymore.
Right. Our economy is not driven by the creation of value. Our economy is driven by the creation of debt. And the object is not to actually pay back the debt by creating value. The object is to pay back the debt by getting other people to go into greater debt. And that's because our biggest business in America is banking, is speculation. The speculative economy is actually bigger than the real economy. So that means that derivatives really outweigh value creation as an economic priority. And that's why we're in trouble.
Now, you've also talked about the centralized currency that we have, I mean, the money system, which we all take for granted. I mean, is there anything else?
Right.
I mean, short of going back to the Middle Ages and, you know, bartering in the markets, is there a different way to do this?
There is, you know, and it's interesting because in the Middle Ages, they had something other than bartering in the markets. They had local currencies. You know, in the old days, back in the Middle Ages, before all this stuff was made illegal, people used to bring grain in from the fields and they'd weigh it at the grain store and you'd get a receipt for the grain that you brought in. So if you brought in, you know, 500 pounds of grain that season, you'd get receipts for 500 pounds of grain. And then you could spend those receipts as money because everyone knew what they were actually worth. Now, when money is created through the abundance of the crop, it is no longer a necessarily scarce resource over which people are competing. It doesn't have the same the bias as the kind of currency that we use. And these towns, and this is why there was such a crisis in the late Middle Ages, this is why the aristocracy went nuts, is that the merchant class was getting rich. The bourgeois, what we call the middle class, was getting richer than the aristocracy because they were trading. There was so much money in these little towns through all this local currency, this abundance-based economy that they had developed. They had so much extra money that they built cathedrals. We call the late Middle Ages the age of cathedrals. And it's not because the Vatican was writing a check for them to build something. It was because there was so much extra money. They were literally investing their money in the future by investing it in real things. What the aristocracy did was said, this is crazy. We can't live in a world like this. So what did they do? They made local currency illegal. I mean, there were wars fought. People died. Blood was spilled. And they said, no, no, you all have to use coin of the realm that's going to be issued from the central treasury by the king with his picture on it. If you use anything else, we'll kill you. And this new money is going to be scarce. We're going to release it in such a way now that you all have to compete over it or pay it back to the central treasury. And it changed the way the economy works. And it's the economy that we live in today, where money is released by the Federal Reserve, where it's literally lent into existence and it has to be paid back in greater quantity than it was borrowed. And how can you pay back more money than exists in circulation? Well, by borrowing more money and so on and so on.
So are you saying that we would be better off now in the 21st century if we had local currencies, a number of local currencies rather than one centralized currency?
I'm saying we'd be better off now if we're going to live in a market society with a free market currency system as well, where people wouldn't have to use a single long-distance fiat centrally issued currency for every single thing in their lives. There are kinds of transactions between me and my CSA, my community supported agriculture group, between me and my babysitter, me and my chiropractor. There are local transactions that could be done more efficiently with local currencies. And long-distance transactions will always be done more efficiently with centralized currencies.
Well, and you tell a story in your book of a local organic restaurant, I guess, near you that wasn't able to do a renovation because the bank froze its lending. And I guess members of the community came forward and contributed some money.
Yeah, well, we didn't really contribute money as much as we invested money. You know, the restaurant called Comfort, he had borrowed half the money he needed to do his renovation. Then the bank froze up And now he's really between a rock and a hard place. He can't go forward because he doesn't have any money, and he can't go back because he owes money to the bank. So what we did was we developed something called Comfort Dollars. Invest $100 and you get $120 credit at the restaurant. So here's a restaurant that we're all going to go to anyway. I mean, there's no question that we're going to be spending our money there. We all go there. So now we get 20% return right away on our investment. And he gets the money he needs to finish his renovation faster and cheaper than he can get it from a bank. So we end up, instead of outsourcing our investment to some Wall Street firm, we can now invest locally. We can help a guy grow a real business that's a good business that actually serves people that we can see. We can improve the quality of our main street and help encourage other businesses to come in. We can have fun doing it, and we create something for ourselves.
So what can we do to reclaim our lives from this corporate society?
I think we got to think small. I think the last thing we should do is join a movement. You know, joining another great internet-branded movement is a way to distract ourselves from terra firma again. I got wailed on by Newsweek that, you know, I had this whole big critique of corporatism, and then my argument for how to get away is the tiny ideas of silly, stupid things like babysitting clubs and local currencies, things that just don't work. It's only the tiny ideas that work. It's our addiction to big ideas, our addiction to some giant movement, institutional change, march on Washington. The idea that we're dependent on Obama for a better life is itself the problem. The fact is we do have the means to care for each other, to grow food, to educate each other, to do the very basic things that people need to enrich their lives. And once you start looking for them in the smallest of ways, even something as simple as trying to set up a system through which you and your friends babysit for each other's kids, it ends up rippling out in ways that you just wouldn't believe.
Doug Rushkoff is the author of Life, Inc., How Corporatism Conquered the World and How We Can Take It Back. He spoke with Steve Paulson. Coming up, a short history of the most common and most hated piece of office furniture, the cubicle. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Did you know that if you work in an office, there's a 60% chance that you work in a cubicle and that you almost certainly dislike it? 93% of the people who work in cubicles would prefer not to. That's a lot of unhappy employees. So how did the fabric-covered box invade and colonize our offices? Nikhil Saval is the author of Cubed, A Secret History of the Workplace, and he traces the birth of the cubicle back to Germany in 1958 and the invention of something called the office landscape, or in German,
the Bürolandschaft. It kind of comes out of the ferment of post-war Germany. It's after the war. They had been closed off from a lot of ideas during the Nazi era, and suddenly all these sort of ideas come rushing in, including American management ideas, and so there's this real ferment around all kinds of things, but work in particular is one of them. And so these two brothers from Hamburg, the Schnelle brothers, they want to create a more egalitarian office. And they want an office that's not reflective of power, of hierarchies, the kind of corridor of private offices reflecting status and prestige, and then the people in the center doing the kind of clerical work reflecting their kind of lowly status. They thought, no, workplaces should reflect the way you work, and they should be based on communication, on paper flow. And so the office landscape is really the origins of what people call the open plan office. There were no walls. It was the desks arranged in these clusters based on your teams or, you know, what you were working on. If you look at the kind of plans for them, they look really chaotic. They're just desks everywhere.
It looks like a high-tech company today.
Exactly. It's meant to reflect what kind of work you're doing. And there's this invisible course of communication and paperwork that is supposed to be running through this office. This was seen as just a huge change. It was a big hit in Europe, and then it migrated to the UK and from there to the United States. And people were used to this sort of international style buildings of the Lever House, things like where there were just regimented desks and glass curtain walls. It was all about just prestige and power. And then to see this that was supposedly egalitarian and free-flowing, that was really exciting for a lot of people.
And when it came to the U.S., one of the people who really fell in love with this concept is this designer, Robert Probst. And you read a lot about him. He's the guy who kind of gave us the cubicle, right?
Yes, poor Robert Probst, who I think never wanted to be known as the inventor of the cubicle. But it's true, he was this sort of maniacal inventor, designer of sorts, although he was never trained properly in the way that, say, the Eameses or Nelson or, you know, other great designers were. He thought a lot about what needed to be fixed about work, and it mainly came from his own work setup. He just realized that workplaces were organized in totally the wrong way. Like the inventors of the Bürolandschaft, he thought that workplaces needed to reflect the way people worked. You know, the original office model was basically based around the factory, the rows of desks that you see in films like The Apartment, or now, again, in Mad Men, those steno pools, accounting pools. They were supposed to be like paperwork factories. But for Probst, he thought that work was not like that, that what people were doing was essentially a kind of mental labor. The term knowledge work had sort of just come into being. And so he wanted to create a furniture system that would be conducive to that kind of work.
So he created this design. He called it the Action Office for Herman Miller back in 58. So what was his Action Office?
There are sort of two versions of it. The version that was the biggest hit, it came out in 1968, and it was this mobile, three-walled, fabric-wrapped walls that were obtusely angled and hinged. They were meant to effectively be just dividers. They could create an individual workspace for someone, or they could be arranged to create a kind of mini conference room. It was meant to be flexible and open. You could pin things to it. You could individualize it. That was the sort of workstation, that's what he called it, that he created. And above all, it was not meant to be put in place. Probst thought that the office was, he called it a facility based on change. There were lots of things. It was constantly changing. So the design was meant to be accommodating to whatever might come to the office, whether that was computerization or new kinds of work, new kinds of workers. You couldn't foresee it. And so you had to just do as little as possible in a way to plan for a new kind of workplace.
So it's this kind of utopian vision of the knowledge worker having more and more autonomy and freedom and flexibility. And instead, poor Probst, it turns into the cubicle.
That's right. It's really, I think, one of the great ironies of office design, of office work. It comes out in 1968, and it's an immediate hit, both with designers, but also with just the mainstream press. I think there's this New York Post piece about how they wonder how office workers could have put up with the designs they had for so long. And Action Office 2 just obliterates all of them. And other furniture companies catch on to this. They start copying Action Office. Over time, what starts to happen in the 70s and 80s is that managers realize that it doesn't really matter whether you want to create autonomy for workers or not. What Action Office and its copies really offer is a tool for cramming more and more workers into less and less space for very little cost. I mean, there's a certain tax write-off. It's depreciable. It's very cheap to have Action Office, much cheaper than a permanent work office. And so it starts to multiply. And you hear designers who are very excited about it initially come out of the installations of these of Action Office or things like it, just completely disheartened, like they have no idea what they've just done.
Another kind of office is this shared office space, the concept of co-working. So different companies will share one central office space. You visited some of those, right?
Yeah, I visited a couple of these at least. And there are sort of a number of models of these. The most common, actually, is the co-working facility that is geared towards freelancers. The co-working facility is in some ways parasitic on the rise of independent contractors and freelancers, which is a growing part of the economy. Nobody's quite sure how much, but it's somewhere between 20 and 25% of white-collar workers might be freelance.
Essentially working for themselves.
That's right. You would think that these workers would not ever want to go back to an office. Like, why, if the sense of the office is about control and authority and cubicles or what have you, why would you go back? But actually, it turns out that in a way to escape the isolation and the very high potential for exploitation in freelancing, you want to be around other people. You want to see sociability, you want to see culture, and meet other people and maybe get together with someone else who might help you in whatever your enterprise happens to be, whether it's graphic design or writing or what have you. Mm-hmm. And that's what I think these co-working facilities are there for. They're like gym memberships. You pay to go to one. You pay for a desk. I mean, that in a way is pretty astonishing. It shows that people may get out of offices, but they still have sort of an office inside them that they want to access.
Your inner office, right?
Your inner office, yeah.
Nikhil, I have this sort of uncomfortable feeling that the way this trend is going is the disappearance of the office completely. We're going to knock down the walls, open up the office, then we're going to freelance more and not even have to go into the office. Pretty soon, all you need is a plug, or maybe not even that.
It's not implausible, that kind of future. I sort of am hesitant to say that anything is coming to an end or disappearing. I mean, it would be sort of too categorical. But it's true that already in our own lifetimes, we see work leaving the building envelope. In a way, it's just leaking out everywhere. Many of us are already working constantly and anywhere, and often far too much or all the time. You know, in a way that the office as such is becoming harder to justify. Certainly, it's harder to justify these giant skyscrapers, although they keep building them, that suck a ton of energy and are wasteful and are not often used all the time. They have lights on all the time. We should be a little bit more comfortable with the idea that this is not a sustainable model and never really has been.
Nikhil Saval is the author of Cubed, A Secret History of the Workplace. Some of the very first jobs I ever had were in cubicles, but the hardest job I ever worked was waitressing. Not only was I not cut out for it, I quit the day after I managed to spill an entire pot of just brewed coffee down my shirt. Candace Taylor reminds me how hard waitressing is. She's the author of a book called Counterculture, based on interviews with career coffee shop waitresses.
Waitressing is not for everyone. And that's the biggest misconception, I think, and that's why it gets such a bad rap. There's this assumption that anybody can wait tables. And it's really not true. You have to be very organized, extremely organized. You have to always be thinking ahead. You have to have incredible personable skills. You really have to be able to read people and anticipate what they want or need, if they want to be left alone or if they want extra attention. There's kind of an innate sensibility that you have to be a good waitress. And if you're not a good waitress, the job is really painful. It can be very difficult and demanding and overwhelming.
Well, so for example, one of the waitresses you met is named Rachel Lelchuk. Can you tell us something about Rachel?
There is a special place in my heart for Rachel Lelchuk. She's just fantastic. She worked at Louis' restaurant for over 55 years. She's just a really special, sweet woman. People meet her once and just never forget her.
I make art of it. I just don't wait on people to wait. I want them to feel pleasantly, make sure everything is hot, pick up your orders right away, and coffee should be nice and hot and tasty, you know, things like that. I didn't punch cards. I was old-fashioned. I took it seriously, you know what I mean? To me, it didn't matter. Like I say, for me, it was a holiday to come to work because I look forward.
Another one of the more memorable waitresses you met is Ronnie Bello.
Oh, yeah.
Ronnie. Can you tell us about her?
Ronnie's very special as well. They're also special, but Ronnie, she's in Worcester. the Boulevard Diner, she just had this warmth to her as well. And just, you know, really asking those questions that at that point, it was early on in the process of me interviewing waitresses when I met Ronnie. And I really started to reevaluate my perspective on what's important in life and what success means.
Well, I don't think the kids today, I don't think they have the stuff that the older girls had. And I think things are handed to them too easy, and I think they don't really know what work is. And if I'm going to come to work and be miserable, I'm not going to come to work. That's what these kids do. They don't want to be here. I tell them, if you don't want to be here, find something you like. I don't care if you drive a taxi cab. I don't care if you clean a sewer. I don't care what you do, but you be happy at what you do. And I'm not ashamed. I can walk with judges and lawyers, and I can fit with anyone because I know what I do, and I'm no phony. This is me. I'm a good waitress. I love people, and that's my attitude. And if you don't like me for that, that's your problem. I'm not a snob.
Candace Taylor's interviews with career waitresses are in her book Counterculture, The American Coffee Shop Waitress. You've heard of the Broadway musical Fiddler on the Roof, right? It was written by a famous songwriting team, Sheldon Harnick and Jerry Bock. But you might not be familiar with another Harnick and Bock collaboration. It's an industrial musical that they wrote for the Ford Tractor and Implement Division. It's called Fordify Your Future. Now, what exactly is an industrial musical? Well, the guy to ask is Steve Young. He's the co-author of Everything's Coming Up Profits, The Golden Age of Industrial Musicals. Doug Gordon sat down with him.
Steve, let's start with the obvious question. What are industrial musicals?
Industrial musicals are musical theater productions that may resemble Broadway shows in many respects. And yet, once you listen to the subject matter, you realize this can't be a Broadway show because they're about selling tires or selling tractors or how great it is to work at Exxon or something to do with some corporate entity and most probably selling the products. These shows were only to be played for company insiders. The public could never go to them. They were motivational, educational. They were supposed to build morale and get everyone on the same page, send you out from the convention or sales meeting with a spring in your step and ready to make a lot of money for yourself and, of course, for the company.
Of course.
He's the most successful salesman in the world. He's the most successful salesman in the world. Reports of his renown have been heard all over town. He's the most persuasive salesman in the world.
How did you discover them?
I was a young writer at the Letterman Show back in the early 90s, and we used to do a comedy bit called Dave's Record Collection. And this consisted of real records, unintentionally funny record albums that Mr. Letterman would hold up on the air. We'd hear a little sample, and he'd have a funny remark. I was the writer in charge of gathering material for this segment, so I would go out to used record stores and thrift shops. I started coming back with these mysterious souvenir records. They were things like General Electric presents Go Fly a Kite or something called My Insurance Man. And I thought, oh, great, a whole musical about selling insurance. Oh, we can make fun of that on television.
Yeah.
As I found a few more, I realized I think I have the beginnings of something strange here, some sort of genre that I've never heard of, and nobody really seems to know what this stuff is. And most stunningly to me, not all of them were great, but the ones that were really good were fantastic. And I would find myself weeks after the record collection segment was over still walking around singing to myself these songs about selling and servicing diesel engines or selling the new model of Royal Typewriter or Westinghouse nuclear power systems. It just seemed like something mysterious is going on here. This stuff is really good. Clearly, a tremendous amount of money was spent on it. No one seems to know what it is, and that kind of set me off on my collecting and researching journey.
And what was it about the good ones that was so fantastic? What appealed to you?
I just loved the collision, the juxtaposition. It seemed like these two things should never go together, peppy show tunes and lyrics about how we're all going to go out and sell the new line of American Standard bathtubs, or we're going to go out there and sell Xerox copiers.
There's only one chap in the copy hall of fame, and the Xerox, Xerox. No one else but Xerox. Xerox is the name.
Is there someone, a Stephen Sondheim of industrial musicals, someone that you could point to as doing the best, most groundbreaking work?
There's a guy named Sid Siegel who was based in Chicago. He worked for decades on this stuff, and I have several shows of his on record, but the crown jewel has got to be The Bathrooms Are Coming.
This is from 1969, right?
Yes, this is a terrific show. The songs are fantastic. The arrangements are slick and first-rate. The cast is firing on all cylinders on a show about bathroom fixtures. It just is one of those things that makes me giddy. It just seems like this should not have been a show. Thank God it is. It will entertain me till the day I die.
Yeah, which company produced The Bathrooms Are Coming?
That was American Standard.
I wanted to ask you about My Bathroom is a Private Kind of Place.
That's right. This is kind of a gateway drug. Anybody who hears this song thinks, what? This can't be real. Not only is it real, it's better than you could have hoped it would be, and it kind of opens the door to how many of these things were there, and are they all this beautifully insane? They're not all this good, but the ones that are good, oh my God. Yes, The Bathrooms Are Coming, My Bathroom.
Another one we should talk about, one that shows that industrial musicals kept up with what was going on in the culture at the time they were produced, is 79 Fever, which, of course, was produced in 1979. Can you tell me about this one?
This one is a souvenir of a Westinghouse office furniture company sales meeting in California in early 79, and they thought, oh, we've got to make it hip and show that we're up with the times. Let's have a disco-themed sales meeting. That's right, 79 Fever with that thudding disco beat, and it has a song on it. It's called 3 Days in 8 Minutes. It's actually 8 minutes and 22 seconds, but let's not worry about that.
Vacation Village, San Diego, January 1979. That's where we all caught a severe case of 79 Fever. After Tuesday night's dinner and a message from Group Executive Vice President John Morris, we really got underway Wednesday morning. Good morning, dance fans, and welcome again to 79 Fever, the world's first sales meeting with a disco beat. There's not one other office furniture manufacturer that hustled through 1978 the way we did. No wonder we've got 79 Fever, and we're going to spread it around the next 3 days with new programs, procedures, and backup plans to help you open every office in the country. And here to start it all off, wearing the shiniest dancing shoes in San Diego, our national sales manager, Don Sullivan.
Here's Don to tell ya what's going down here. He'll lead the band now. He'll wear the crown here. He's got the fever.
We got the fever. We got the system. We got the fever. We got the system. We got the fever.
We've had this on the Letterman show. We've played it a few places. It's one of these things that it's like a car wreck and you can't really look away. It's maybe what finally killed off disco.
Did it kill off the industrial musicals too, though?
They persisted for a few more years, but by the 80s, things were changing, and it was no longer a novelty. I think that was part of it. It was new and exciting in the 50s and in the 60s, and then by the 70s, oh yeah, convention. Yeah, they'll have a musical, I guess. Yeah, we're used to that now. Technologically, companies were realizing we could save a lot of money if we have these reusable AV modules and packages with pre-recorded music and put up something on a big screen, some motivational message, and somebody climbing rocks and saying, let's achieve excellence. We don't need to hire a 40-piece orchestra and some rather expensive composer to spend weeks writing us a new show.
So maybe video and technology didn't just kill the radio star, maybe also the industrial musical.
It definitely helped do it in. There was technology, economics, changing tastes. I'm just happy that enough of these things were recorded and given out as souvenir records, and I'm still probably going to be finding them for a long time.
Have you and your co-author, Sport Murphy, ever thought about turning Everything's Coming Up Profits, your book, into an off-Broadway industrial musical? It seems to me that, you know, in this current age of product placement and advertorial, it might be a huge hit. You could get all of these corporations to underwrite it, couldn't you, Steve?
Well, I think that's an excellent idea.
Thank you.
At the very beginning stages of talking about things like this, of course, you want to get the companies on your side. I think a lot of them now would look back at something from 40 years ago and say, wow, this is a part of our history that we don't even really know about anymore, and we're happy to revisit this. The stuff from the 60s has this Mad Men look and feel. It's very hot right now.
Yeah, but exactly.
It's this wonderfully American, touching story of musical theater and out-and-out capitalist selling that combines, and you think it shouldn't work, and when it does work, it's really kind of a revelation.
Computer can sort and computer can store all the data and facts that you may have need for. In your distribution system, our sensors can lurk, saving lots of trouble, lots of money, lots of work.
Steve Young is the co-author, along with Sport Murphy, of Everything's Coming Up Profits, the Golden Age of Industrial Musicals. We spoke with Doug Gordon. And that's it for our conversation about the American working life. But coming up, the Indian parliamentary elections are on our minds this week, along with a dangerous idea. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. And now it's time for A Dangerous Idea.
I'm Colson Whitehead, and my dangerous idea is the Lit Mode 100. The novel is dead. The memoir is dead. The short story is twitching. The author is getting ripe. Who can keep up? Have you ever wished for a new literary form, impervious to the ins and outs of critical fashion and the latest manifesto? Ever pine for a writing genre that escapes trendy labels and confounds reviewers who take their personal enthusiasm for universal values? Meet the Lit Mode 100. The Lit Mode 100 is a state-of-the-art, fully adjustable, lightweight writing module. Constructed from the highest quality literary materials and designed by working fiction writers, it's compact, dishwasher safe, and comes with an easy-to-use drop-down thesaurus. The Lit Mode 100 is engineered to withstand the assault of establishment critics, anonymous bloggers, and even common internet trolls, up to a rated pressure of over 1,200 CPDs, or comments per day. The Lit Mode 100 comes with two interchangeable base units, poetic and narrative. Poetic is perfect for today's writer on the go. Small enough to fit in your pocket, but big enough to contain multitudes. Once you've selected your base unit, You simply snap on the genre format or gen form you want to use. It's that simple. We guarantee that you'll go from idea to finished writing product in under 5 minutes or your money back. Here's how it works. Suppose you like the roominess of the essay, but you also want license to make things up while staying in your comfort zone of nonfiction. No problem. Take the narrative-based unit and snap on the memoir and fabulous gen forms. It's so easy, even a first semester MFA student can do it. Let's say you wake up in the morning and you're feeling narrative, coming of age, third person, omniscient. Snap it on. Around lunchtime, you experience intimations of mortality and get a hankering for poetic, hermetic, quotidian. Snap it on. Then when it's time for a night out with some drunken Russian symbolists, you switch to narrative, lyrical, mimetic, and hit the town without care. Snap it on. Act now and we'll throw in the IB4E spell checker for free. That's 2 lit mode base units, the Gen Form starter kit, and the IB4E spell checker, all for the low, get up and write price of $29.95. Call now and we'll throw in a special limited edition commemorative daguerreotype of Emily Dickinson in an erotic pose. Don't get upset. Snap it on.
Colson Whitehead with A Dangerous Idea. His latest book is called The Noble Hustle, Poker, Beef Jerky, and Death. You'll find more dangerous ideas on our website at ttbook.org. And now it's time for On Our Minds. This week, the Indian election is on our minds, so we turn to one of India's most celebrated writers, Arundhati Roy. She's famous not only for her best-selling novel, A God of Small Things, but also for her outspoken political activism against India's power structure, including the newly elected Hindu Nationalist Party. Steve Paulson recently sat down with Roy to talk about how she sees her role as a writer and activist.
Arundhati, you seem to occupy a unique place in world literature. You're a celebrated novelist, winner of the Booker Prize in 1998 for The God of Small Things, which became an international sensation. But since then, all of your published writing, as far as I'm aware, has been nonfiction, has been very political. Do you see your work as a novelist and all this other work that you've been doing as an activist as totally different, or are they related in some way?
Well, what happened in India very soon, I mean, just after my book came out and I won the Booker Prize, it was at a time when India was looking to position itself as this new emerging superpower. And I was claimed not so much for my book as for the prize that I won, as, you know, a person who had been recognized in the international arena. I think within a few months of the Booker Prize, which had me on the cover of every magazine and so on, the Indian government conducted these nuclear tests. And suddenly there was this horrible, ugly, nationalistic, almost fascist rhetoric, you know. Honestly, it was like suddenly everybody had had a large dose of Viagra or something. And I saw that even artists and writers and actors and everybody was claiming these nuclear tests with great pride.
Because this was sort of this moment when India had become a nuclear power, right? This historical moment.
And all of this combined to make me feel very, very uncomfortable. And also, since I was on this national stage, I realized that keeping quiet about it was as political as saying anything. So that's when I wrote the first essay called The End of Imagination, which, of course, had people just kick me off the pedestal of being the sort of fairy queen. And then they were like, get out of India and all of that.
So you were no longer the darling of Indian letters.
Just overnight, I was no longer the darling. In the last 10 or 12 years, what has happened is that the political work, the political writing I've done has been urgent and interventionist, you know. So I've been trying to sort of blow open a space that's closing in on people. So that urgency, the immediacy of having to intervene is different from fiction. You know, once I wrote The End of Imagination, I sort of declared myself as a person who wasn't frightened of being in trouble.
And also, I mean, you've been a very outspoken activist on a number of issues. I mean, you've already mentioned the nuclear testing. You've been a critic of Indian nationalism, of globalization, of a series of big dams being built in India. Is there an underlying set of values for you that brings all of these things together? I mean, is there a vision of society that you are advocating that you think we don't have, we're missing?
Absolutely. I mean, what I'm talking about is really in the battle between power and powerlessness, how do you resist? What are the tactics you employ? In India, for instance, there is such a huge bandwidth of resistance against the push of, let's say, these major mining corporations to take over the lands of millions of people. Really, the battle is how do you redefine the meaning of human happiness and fulfillment? How do we learn that what we are fighting for is not making us happy? It's not doing anything for us.
Is this a critique of, I guess, what you might call the idea of progress in the modern
world? Absolutely. That is at the heart of it. You know, we need to redefine what we mean by progress, what we mean by civilization, what we mean by development. You know, today, the measure of progress is almost synonymous with your levels of consumption, which is psychotic. It's crazy.
Well, I want to bring this back to your own personal story. And I guess I'm wondering, as you talk about these various political issues, these problems that, that are not only in India, but around the world, were you aware of all of this when you were growing up? I mean, were you a political child?
No, I wasn't. I wasn't a political child in that I didn't grow up in a family that had a deep political understanding. And yet, as in The God of Small Things, you know, Kerala was at the time, when I was growing up, it seemed the revolution was just around the corner. But I grew up on the outside of a very, very traditional community, a very conservative community, a very landed community who looked at us as sort of outcasts and, you know.
But why were you considered an outcast?
Well, because my mother had married outside the community, then was divorced. You know, she didn't have any money and all of that. So you grew up sort of asking yourself questions. I'm not schooled in the normal ways of politics or anything. You know, much of my political writing is almost trying to explain to myself what's going on. It's not just preaching to other people.
How much of this comes from your perspective growing up as a girl in a traditional community? I mean, it sounds like part of what you're saying is that you didn't want to fulfill the traditional female role that was expected of you.
Sure. I grew up as a girl in a community where my mother was very, very unorthodox because of what she had been through. So she was not exactly putting pressure on me to be like the other girls, you know. But I was so sure that I wasn't going to get married to some local boy there with a dowry. But she and my mother and I also had a lot of conflict, so I actually ran away from home when I was 16, 17, and I was studying architecture in Delhi. But
So studying architecture, not fiction?
No, I'm an architect. Yeah.
When did fiction enter your life?
Fiction entered my life long ago, but I knew that, at least I thought that I could never, ever earn a living, writing. So I was very desperate to study something where I could support myself financially and never be dependent on anybody and so on. So that's one of the reasons I studied architecture.
Is there a connection between your architectural background and your fictional writing? Do you sort of bring the imagination of an architect to how you construct a novel?
Absolutely, I do. I think not just a novel, but even all my political writing. I think structure is everything in a way. How you tell a story is as important as the story, because, you know, the stories of love and fear and war and terror and childhood, stories have been told, you know. None of us are all that unique, however much we are told that we are great individuals and, you know, all that. But how you tell a story, how you reveal it, you know, and even in in the political writing that I do, I think all of those skills are put to use in how you unpack something or how you present something or how you look at something, you know?
So you don't really see a sharp distinction between what you do as a novelist and what you do in your more explicitly political writing?
I do. The difference, I think, is the difference of playing, you know, of having the space to play when you're writing fiction. When I'm writing nonfiction, it's an intervention where you're sort of surgically going into a chaotic political situation and saying, look, let's just open this up and say, what the hell are you all talking about? Whereas in fiction, there's so much dance and so much play and so much love and irony. And in India, for example, when you're writing politically, irony is a real problem.
What can great literature do to help to create this better world that you've been talking about? Or can it? I mean, is that the job of what literature is about?
I would never be one of those to specify, you know, what the job of literature is. You know, I think literature should be free to do what it wants. So I would not prescribe a role for literature.
You would
literature.
Not prescribe a more
never,
political role in literature.
I would not prescribe any role for literature. But obviously, when I say I don't prescribe a role, I think that all literature is political, even a fairy tale. I mean, no writer can hide behind their words. There are writers who I think are just, you know, their politics really sucks, but they're beautiful writers, you know, so you can't deny the beauty of that too.
Now, the first thing that every journalist who writes about you says is you wrote this amazing book, this novel, The God of Small Things, back in the late 90s. Why haven't you written another novel? Are you working on one?
Yes, I am, actually. But when I wrote The God of Small Things, I already knew that there was no way that I was going to write another book very soon. Because I don't see myself as some, you know, novel-producing factory. I don't see the point of writing, you know, 100 novels. For me, The God of Small Things was something which had been marinating for a long time. And I'm not a very ambitious person. I'm not somebody who necessarily, you know, wants to be remembered or wants to win some big prize or something. I would like to, as I once said, sort of eat mangoes in the moonlight and be a bit irresponsible.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Arundhati Roy is the author of the Booker Prize-winning novel, The God of Small Things. If you'd like to hear more, you'll find Steve's complete uncut interview with Roy on our website at ttbook.org. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Wisconsin Public Radio. Doug Gordon produced today's show with help from Charles Monroe Kane, Sarah Nix, Stephanie Youngblood, and Raymond Tungekar. Special thanks to audio engineers Brittany True and Joe Hartke. Our theme music is by Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. And I'm Ann Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.